A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Office, you know, they'll be like, Benjamin Horowitz. And I'm like, when in your life have you seen an OR without an E after it pronounced whore, you know?
So you go to the doctor and he calls you a whore.
He does.
That's not a good sign.
He grabs my testicles and he calls me a whore, Brad. It was a rough time at the docs last time I was there.
That's supposed to be before you get married, those kind of like worrying doctor's appointments.
From my impression, they seem to get worse and more invasive. Like, I was just listening to something about, like, you go in for one thing, and then all of a sudden, he's sticking his fingers up your butt for, like, a prostate exam.
I've been there.
You've done that already.
I'm there. I'm at that age, dude.
When does that start?
Actually, you're about to, dude.
39? You're supposed to get your butt checked?
Yeah, I think 40, maybe. I feel like the first time I did it, maybe I had the wrong doctor or the right doctor.
What if I tell him I self-exam regularly?
I think I was under 40.
Okay. Now, I don't want to pry too deeply, but when you did this exam, was it the first time that something was in there?
Well, by a doctor, of course.
By a doctor. Let's not get to the 90s. Brad just finished telling me that he used to love opening slots in the 90s because he could just finish up, pack up, and get wasted.
It is true, dude.
I wish I could see 90s Brad. Did you have long hair?
Only at the very beginning.
When were we talking about footwear?
I used to wear like engineer boots or Chuck Taylors, either one.
You went for it pretty hard. Leather coat?
I had a leather I had bikes, dude.
Oh, you were still riding?
Yeah.
Man, oh, you must have been so much fun.
That was so cool.
You were so fun. And now Richard Dreyfuss walks in here. Just another stakeout.
Just another fucking day at the office.
Hey, Brad.
So,
nice to be back here in the saddle.
For real. That was a long summer.
Yeah. That was like a sweeter summer.
It was like
it took like two solstices.
It was like an 18-month summer.
Yeah. We should call it, it's some kind of equinox. It's a new one. I don't know, we'll rename it. I've been wanting to get in touch with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
He would be fantastic.
Oh, what a great interview.
What a great human.
Did you ever see those pictures of him in like the 80s?
No.
He's jacked.
Really?
Yeah, nice looking man.
Wow.
Yeah, he
what a
like.
Catch.
Yeah, he was a real, like, he must have been a real rock and roller of the physics industry.
All right, I'll look into it. Because now that we are about to relaunch.
Dun, dun.
Reboot, whatever you want to call it, going off track. We apologize to you loyal listeners.
Yeah.
And there are a bunch of you. Yeah, we were going to take the summer off last year.
Last year.
And we did. And then
another year after
life caught up to us.
It did. Well, how's your life been the last 2 years, Brown?
My life hasn't been that unchanged. It's busy. But yeah, so what happened? I don't know. We're going to check in with Jonah later. Because,
yeah, Jonah's going to dial in.
I mean, the main thing was, you know, we lost our favorite recording space. Pulse was fine for a while, but it just wasn't the same as doing it at Rubber Tracks. And then Jonah turned into a mountain man.
And 300 episodes. I mean, nothing to scoff at. Think, what, Taffer was 304.
Yeah, we needed a break.
That's a lot of episodes.
It was okay to take the summer off.
So I think Jonah's just... He's grown a really long beard. I'd imagine he has a really long beard right
now. Yeah, I would hope so.
And just in the last 2 years, almost in the way like Gandalf went from like gray to white. I think Jonah's like, I think he's got different colored eyes now. like his clothes changed without changing, all of it.
Well,
yeah.
We should ask him. We should just give him a call. Let's call him.
Let's call him.
Hello?
Oh! Hey, Jonah.
Hey, how's it going?
No, it's going okay. I'm sitting here with Benny, dude.
Hi, Jonah.
Hey, Benny. How are you?
I'm good. I love you. I miss you.
Yeah. You know, we just did an intro for the show that Benny recorded with Laura Jane Grace. And we wish that you were here to help intro it. But we were kind of talking about the fact that we haven't been around for a while.
Yeah.
Where are you?
Yeah.
We didn't say where you were, though.
Yeah, we were very cryptic.
Yeah, that's good.
We accused you of being a mountain man, though.
Yeah, I had said that you... I didn't say what you were doing or where you are, but I said you most likely have an extremely long beard and that I think your eyes have changed color, like Gandalf the gray to Gandalf the white, and you've like achieved like a different level of existentialism that you haven't prior.
How much of that is true?
Yeah.
All of it.
Yes! I knew it!
All of it is true.
I knew it.
But seriously, what are you up to? Tell your fans, man. They miss you.
Oh, this is being recorded now?
Yeah! Dude, you know going off track, we're always recording. Remember that. You know the drill.
Yes. Yeah. What's going on with me? I'm kind of like segueing into like a new aspect of my career, kind of like an extension, maybe the podcast in some ways. I'm in school for clinical mental health counseling. So I've just been learning more about interviewing and counseling, and I want to work with musicians and creative people. You know, part of it was kind of inspired in some way by like our Scott Hutchinson interview. Like I was, you know, that was a really one of my favorite podcasts. And so it was, you know, really sad. So it got me kind of thinking about, you know, how I can maybe try to work with musicians or work with people just kind of dealing with those kinds of issues. And it's like a long path, but I'm excited for it. And I'm happy that the podcast is still going on. And, you know, we'll see what my involvement can be, but I'd like to pop in once in a while and still, you know, be involved in some level. And I'm happy that Benny did this interview with Laura. I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm sure it's great.
Oh,
that's okay. I don't know. Yeah,
I'm sure it's good. And I was thinking too, you know, like the first live event we did with Benny was with Laura and Dan Ozzie for that book release.
Oh, that's right. That sold out book release.
Yeah, that was my first like being on stage as a host. Remember, I had been a guest for Union Hall episode 100. That's when I finagled my way into Antarctica Vespucci because I met Jeff Rosenstock that night. That was pretty funny.
Oh, that's how that happened.
He told me about this band him and Chris Farron are doing. I'm like, who's playing drums on that? I just like nosed my way in there. Yeah, like for sure.
I did not know that.
But yeah, I've been working on that and, you know, I'm still writing. So like I try to keep, you know, my writing stuff updated. I've been doing a lot of bios.
What about music?
What about the band?
You got a garage up there in the woods?
No garage, no. I'm still playing, you know, I play around the house. You know, United Nations is always very kind of cryptic as well. So, I don't know.
That's always, been part of the vibe, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think it might be time for you to shift into like, I always wonder, like, if I'm getting a massage or something, who's making that like transcendental, like meditation music that plays like the whole time. What about that, Jonah?
I wonder who makes that stuff too. Like, I wonder because it can be so repetitive. Like, who is like, I nailed this one.
I know. But, who like listens back and is like, oh fuck, that's good. That's good. That's the best one I've done. Yeah,
it's a robot.
I don't know. I don't know where that music comes from. Honestly, I don't know anyone. No one has ever really sent me that kind of music. I get sent still a lot of music.
You think there's just one pan flute guy, like the pan flute guy who just makes a fucking killing, you know, they're like, yeah, we need some pan flute. Call Ed. he's around.
And when he's not in the studio, he's just making loops for everybody else.
Yeah, pan flute guy. That's a fucking wheelhouse right there.
But, Jonah, it's awesome to talk to you for real. And we do miss you for real as well. So,
I know. I miss you guys, too. And, like, you know, I've gotten some emails from people asking me about the podcast as well. I just wanted to say thanks. Oh, one more thing that just happened, kind of related to the podcast, it's cool, is Dave Bazan has a new documentary out called Strange Negotiations. And the director, Brandon Vetter, was with him when they were making it, and they filmed it in Going Off Track. And where it's me interviewing Dave for the podcast is in the documentary for like 10 seconds or something.
Ah, oh, that's awesome.
No shit.
It's like I'm asking him a question, and then it cuts to us like sitting in Studio B.
Is the doc out?
I think it just came out.
Is that Netflix or something?
I think it's available on iTunes. It's really cool. It's shot really well. It's really, and I was part of the Kickstarter for it, so I've been getting updates on it a lot. They've been working on it basically like for, I don't know, at least like 3 years, I think. But there's like a little scene of the now defunct Rubber Track Studios in the documentary.
Pour one out.
But I mean, thanks everyone that's emailed. And I just, you know, like I still keep in touch with everyone. I just saw Steven. Hopefully, you know, you guys can keep it going, and, you know, we can be, you know, we can also be involved. And I think it's great.
Cool, dude.
Awesome.
It's great to hear from you. We'll be in touch.
Thanks, Jonah.
Okay.
Be good, bud. We love you.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye. Oh, I love Jonah so much. It's just like talking to him just soothes. He's always been the most soothing guy.
He's definitely picked a good career other than podcasting.
Yeah.
He's going to help people out.
He's one of those people that I've like sat down to like eat with and stuff. And within like 15 minutes, I'm just telling him shit.
Right.
That like, I'm like, what? What the fuck? I'm not supposed to be telling you this.
Well, some people listen, man.
And he's a non-judgmental person. Like, you know, like when you're saying that he's processing it in not like a where to put you kind of way, but like he's focusing on the right things when he's talking to you. Well, I'm glad he's still involved, and I'm glad he gave us his job less and that we're allowed to keep doing this, you know, because it's fun. So this interview, Brad.
Yeah, Laura.
So the little backstory on this is my band Mercy Union did a 6-week U.S. tour opening up for Laura Jane Grace, her main support, second of three. Really cool tour. It started in mid-March in Houston, which meant, you know, a 24-hour drive to start the tour. But you know what I did? I pulled the, hey, I have kids. I'm going to fly out and meet you guys there. Like, oh, sorry. Extra day with the fam.
Hey,
you know?
Flight Gotta to Houston do doesn't Gotta really do cost that much. No, it's one of the cheaper places to fly
decent.
Into.
Yeah, it's decent.
Doesn't hurt.
And did that, and we started the tour here. It ended up being a burner, man. 6 weeks around the U.S., van tour. Like I said, we were second of three, which means you load in early,
right?
You sound check early, then you have to take your shit off stage and put it somewhere weird.
That's definitely the worst slot.
And the band you're hearing while I'm interviewing Laura is the band Control Top, who is the opening band, who not only got to open, they also used my drums. So it was like, I mean,
what so we a, don't have to get a sync fee to play their music.
What a coast. I gave Alex, the drummer, I gave a lot of shit through the tour. I was definitely a lot of razzing. But good people. They were fun to be on tour with. And so I had delayed doing this interview almost like the whole tour because I was like, I don't want to be the jag like the first week of this tour. Just be like, hey, Laura, could I get an interview? Like, I just wanted it to be cool. But then like there was like no time towards the end, and the clock was ticking, and I'm like, oh, great, last day of tour, so now we have to do it.
Is this really last day?
This is the last. So I had 6 weeks to conduct this interview, and I did it.
And what town is it?
This is in Nashville.
Right.
I believe Basement East is in West Nashville, which is like It's like the Brooklyn of Nashville.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, it doesn't look like Brooklyn, but, you know, it's where young liberal hipsters go in Nashville to stake their land and claim and eat overpriced pizza and stuff.
And the bird, the local bird you can hear through the whole thing.
I know, which is great. I would love if any ornithologists possibly listen to Going Off Track.
ID the birds.
Yeah, like
bonus
maybe,
points, yeah, man.
We'll give you a free, I don't know, what can we offer?
So we'll give him maybe that beanie that you're wearing.
Okay. You don't want that stinky, stinky stuff under here, my friend. But yeah, so it was a lot of fun. I've known Laura a long time. I mean, actually, Against Me was one of the first bands who gave Gaslight a real tour.
Oh,
So we supported Against Me when they released New Wave on a national tour that ended up being a really good thing for us, you know, and something that really boosted us. And then once Gaslight got bigger, we had brought Against Me on tour. And then, you know, things unfold. And then Laura has a solo project and still brings my band on tour. So it's really cool.
Well, cool. Let's check it out, man. The first Going Off Track in like 18 months. Get right to it. Let's listen to Laura.
It's Going Off Track!
Do you have a cassette player?
I do. I actually have a really extensive cassette collection, too.
Still keep them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, did you ever put them somewhere, or do you always have them around?
I used to have one of those, like, or a couple of those, like, wooden racks or that you could hang on a wall, and I would do that. But I just have a drawer, like, in my office studio room that's full of cassettes. I, like, have been in the habit for the past couple of years of making mixtapes, too.
Since
I have, like, a double cassette deck, you know? And just like making mixtapes to give to friends. And then I did for when our record came out in November, I made 5 mixtapes, and on each one I put an unreleased recording that was just like me on my little like shitty boombox doing a demo of a song or a cover, and I hid it in the track listing on each mixtape, and then went to my local record store in Chicago and was like, hey, can you just give these to the next 5 people that come in and buy the record? And then I tweeted that, and then 5 people came in and bought the record and got free tapes.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. What a special thing to people.
I'm sure that those 5 people didn't have cassette decks themselves. They were just, like, stoked to get the tapes.
What's, like, when you decide to do that? Like, you are... Is that just, like, fuck it, I have this stuff, it's for fun? Or are you, like, really trying to, like... reach out to your people, like make sure you're like available like that
for fun, like for fun totally, and because it was like went with like what was going on with the record and how it came about. Like I'd held on to the stupid cassette tape collection for years, and then when we were making the last Against Me record, I was kind of like half living at Mark's studio, and that was when I finally got a new cassette deck. And there was like lots of down moments where, you know, Ian Gay was working on a bass track, or that there was some editing happening or whatever. And I just started making mixtapes again, and just like as a productive way to kill time. And I don't know, like it's like a conflicted feeling with the format, because on the one hand, like I really don't like nostalgia for formats. Like even Record Store Day kind of bugs me. Like, and the idea of a cassette tape day is just like, you know, if it's gonna die, just let it die, you know?
Is that happening now? Cassette tape day?
Yeah, they do cassette tape day. But when I think back too, it's like legitimately how Against Me started was cassette tapes and like 4-track recordings, dubbing my own copies and giving them out. That's just where the band came from, and I just have like a attachment to it because of that.
Yeah, how could you not have an attachment with tapes at people our age, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like records existed when we were born. They were already a thing, and CDs weren't a thing yet.
Right.
I didn't get my first CD till I was like 12.
Sure.
Like that. All my first music was on tape. Yeah, making mixes. Do you remember? I used to name all my mixes like all sorts of weird shit. I remember I had anytime I was listening to like Rev Record stuff, like Sense Field or like Far Side, I would always call it like Easy Listening, because that was my easy listening at the time. I think I had one called Nocturnal Emissions, just because I probably just learned what it meant and thought it was funny.
Yeah.
Did you name them?
Totally. Yeah. It was like, you know, I still have like a collection too of mixtapes that were made for me from friends, and there's like, you know, there's early Against Me tours one. I have one that's like, I survived this tour and all I got was this lousy mixtape, or like, you know, like spring mix, blah, 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 and blah, blah, you know, like oftentimes they were like whatever lyrical reference from a song that would be on there or some shit like that. But
so I was going to ask you, I was thinking about how you have like a whole bunch of songs about escaping Florida, or at least more than one.
A lot of songs.
Yeah. And now there's a deep hatred for Chicago in a lot of ways, enough to pen a song, at least like get behind something enough that like you printed it on a fucking shirt. Like, like if anybody else hates Chicago, you know, and also you're, I don't know if, have sports fans picked up on that? Like Detroit Red Wings fans and like people like that? Like
there was people saying when we were about to go to Milwaukee and Madison, people were like, oh, that shirt or that mug will do well in Wisconsin. But I forgot to ask Daniel if there was like a spike in sales or whatever. But the, you know, like honestly, like that song is like, it's like half in jest, where if like you're telling me that you think it's funny and it's like, and you get the joke, then I'll admit to you, like, I don't really hate Chicago.
Right.
But if you're saying, like, if you have a problem with that, then I will stand by hating Chicago, and I will, like, fight for that.
If someone gets, like, puffy-chested with you about it.
Yeah, then it's like, well, fuck you. Fuck Chicago, then. Like, it's just a city. And, like, what... Also, you know, it's, like, one of those things that you could break down further of, like, what are you talking about? Like, are you defending the city of Chicago?
Right.
Like, the city government of Chicago? Or are you, like... Because otherwise, it's just,
or the
like...
sports teams.
What
is it that you're actually protecting?
Because, obviously, I don't hate a group of people based on their geographical location or anything like that. You know, like, that's just dumb. And, when it comes down to it existentially, like borders are illusions, the city is an illusion other than like you know the government that's set up there.
Sure.
You know,
I heard that Chicago is called the Windy City because of its old blustery politicians who lied and fucked around all the time.
I do believe that's true. Yeah, I actually, like, last year when I was feeling the way I was feeling when I wrote that song, I was like, I'm going to make a committed to effort to really invest myself in learning about the city.
Yeah.
And like, I read like The Devil in the White City. I went and did all the like tours of the Haymarket, like where Haymarket Riot took place, went up in the Sears Tower, Hancock Building, whatever. And just like learned a lot about Chicago, or tried to, or whatever.
Yeah. The reason I brought it up was the thing I was thinking about is because we've talked a little on this tour about me hating where I live too, and just the nuisance of like living in a city in general and this. But then I was thinking, I'm like, oh wait, Laura has a lot of songs hate about Florida. Anywhere I used to live, I just talk shit about anyway. And I'm like, maybe it's us. It's like that, you know how you have like a roommate who's like always complaining about people being filthy or something, and it's just them?
Yeah, totally.
Or like that person who moves to like four different houses in a year and complains about shitty roommates, like, you're the shitty roommate if that's the fact. So basically I'm saying, could you put semi-poisonous people like us anywhere and we'll just find all the things to hate?
I think so. I think that's like completely valid, and also like I definitely recognize that like when I leave someplace, I miss it then. And I really like see the good in it, and I'm like, damn, I really wish I would have appreciated those things about Florida when I lived in Florida, but I hated Florida when I lived there, and now that I'm out of there, I hate where I've moved to, and I wish I could go back out to Florida. And I'm sure when I move out of Chicago, I'll be like, you know what, I really miss some things about Chicago.
Cool. Those Bulls jerseys are cool.
I will say, I have always wanted to rock a Bulls jersey, specifically because in the Rancid Salvation video, opening scene, there's that punk wearing the Bulls jersey, and like I remember seeing that when I was 13 years old, being like, damn, that's a badass look.
Tight.
Like, you got the charged out hair and the piercings and tattoos, and you're wearing a Bulls jersey
or a starter jacket, something like that could be tight. I don't know, I'd rock one, but yeah, I don't know. I wonder about that stuff, like just the idea that, like, how do you then, like, on that logic, if you could place people like us anywhere and you start to get upset anywhere, then what's, like, Is it, are we like too old to change?
It's punk rock though. That's what, like, a lot of it is attributed to punk rock, where like punk rock teaches you to figure out what you don't like about something. You know, you question it and you're like,
true.
This is what, like, defining yourself as a punk is defining what you're against. I am against war. I'm against repression. I'm against poverty. Uh-huh. Rarely being punk is it about, like, these are the things I'm really passionate and for and want to, like, you know, like, bringing out the positive in something. And so, I mean, fuck, I'm 38. I've been into punk since I was, like, 12. You know, like,
same.
I don't think that it's possible to change necessarily this way. And I also don't think it's a bad thing also, you know. It's just when people have a problem with it, it's like, why are you so fucking defensive? You didn't build the fucking city.
Like, why do you have to be so madly in love with, like, the place you're at?
Yeah, and if something, like, it's the same with a flag. Like, a flag means nothing if you can't burn it, you know?
Right.
Like, if you're upset about the idea of burning an American flag, then it makes me want to burn an American flag that much more, you know?
Sure.
Whereas otherwise, if you had no problem with it, I have no desire to burn an American flag, you know?
Yeah, that's one of the things, like, I wonder, I mean, just with a lot of what's going on lately... Like, for instance, for me, like, I barely even considered myself even remotely Jewish until, like, Trump got elected and all this crazy shit started happening.
Right.
And, like, I said a couple things online and got, like, straight, like, troll Nazi attacked. With, like, one of those things where, like, 20 people send you, like, hook-nose photos and shit like that, like, all at once. And maybe it's, like, the punk rock side of me. It's not, like, I want to move. I don't want to do this. It's, like, I want to, like, get a gun and be ready to, like, kill people who go anywhere near me who want to hurt me, you know? And I would have... I seriously never even remotely thought that way until, like, someone made this, like, concerted effort to, like, make me feel that way.
I think that's the obvious danger of social media and, like, the danger of Trump. Doing, you know, posting the hate that Trump posts, and talking the way that they post, is that it does make targets out of people, and that it does create that defensiveness and an offensiveness too. And, you know, like, I feel terrible about it, and I feel really, like, guilty and complicit in it, in that I participate in social media and I don't see it as a long-term, like, sustainability thing, you know? Like, I don't think it's very punk, you know, but it's, like, a part of what we do as musicians with promoting your art and everything like that. And it's terrifying in thinking about it as, like, well, those older media outlets and print and all those, the way that punks used to organize themselves are going to disappear, and everyone is going to be solely reliable on social media, and that will be controlled, you know, like, and that's, you know, so easily manipulated with trolls and bots and stuff like that. And that, I don't know.
And even the information that you're being fed on your own feed being tailored to specifically what you already think.
Sure.
And only things that interest you. Like they literally know how to make like hamsters like pegging for, like, pellets and water out of us. Like, they're so much smarter than us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Walking into the venue yesterday, there was the two security guards at the back door, and it's like, walking past them, they didn't even look up from their phones. Like, are you paying attention here? Like, did anyone stroll in here right now? And, you know, I hate to be like that person. It's like, back in the day, blah, blah, blah. But you think about it, like, well, like, what the fuck did security guards do sitting outside of a venue back in the day? You didn't just stare at your phone. Like,
no.
There had to be a different mentality going on, you know?
They couldn't wait to talk to you back in the day. I had so many weird conversations with fucking security guards. They're just waiting for someone to walk by, right? How many good stories? Yeah. I always say the best, if you want to hear the best, like, tall tales on earth, sit in a bus driver's circle in a festival in Europe and just listen. Yeah. Just listen to those elaborated nuggets from, like, around the world.
Well, you don't have any choice but to listen either, because bus drivers will never stop talking and will not let you get an urgent word in edgewise. You know?
Or if you say something, you just start to rip to shreds in, like, some northern English. I remember talking about this recently with our mutual friend, Chris Farron. Praise him.
His birthday is soon, right?
I think, like, tomorrow, based on the countdown. Speaking of social media, the king of social media. And, you know, Chris obviously, like, sort of, just doesn't partake in like political stuff. And I talked to him about that, and you know, he believes the idea that for someone like him, like his greatest way to even keep contributing in a good way and make things move forward in a good way is like continue to like really work at what he does and what he knows how to do and continue like crafting songs in a certain way. And that's the best way for him to fight it.
And I think that's completely valid. And I think it's really like, it's important to recognize there too, the element of subversion within that of like,
right,
when you see what the crowd or the mob is doing, do the opposite. So if everyone is talking about politics and everyone is tweeting the same shit, do the fucking opposite.
Exactly.
And that's going to be way more powerful than just following the herd. Even if like what the herd is saying is completely valid, you know, like it's just, it's more effective, you know?
But is there like any sensibility to the idea that like, say if the shit was and still maybe is going to really go down, you know what I mean? Like in this country, like, you know, I have a sort of morbid sensibility that it's going to get far worse before it gets better.
I agree.
And like where we no longer have the ability to step back and just create if we want to.
Right.
Like there is like, there is an element of like space and freedom. I hate to use that word, but even just like a personal freedom to be able to have that like time and resources to just do that.
Right.
Like that's happened to a lot of people. Like talk to maybe every musician who lived in certain countries in the Middle East during like the Arab Spring,
mm-hmm.
who used to have musical equipment or practice space, used to get together with people like every Thursday and play music, you know what I mean? Stuff like that. And it got taken away from them.
Right.
You know, they didn't have a choice.
Right. But there'll never be a point in history where people are looking back on now and saying, damn it, if only Chris Barron would have tweeted something anti-Trump, things wouldn't have gone the way they went. You know, that's not the deciding factor.
Right.
And I do think that, like, you know, I think I've thought a lot about it on this tour of, like, what's the most effective way to fight back about against that fear and everything. And I really do believe it's be the best version of yourself that you can. And I think about it on levels of, like, you know, yeah, it means eating a vegan diet, you know, and that's something that I need to work on. Or yeah, it means like, you know, don't be a fucking wasted asshole, you know, and like work on your craft, you know, work on what you're doing and do it to the best of your abilities. Because otherwise, I just think you're like falling into the cesspool of the shit and they're getting the best of you in that way. You know?
Sure. The older I get, I see a lot more value as like a punk and an independent person in being healthy.
Oh yeah.
Like just keep me the fuck out of a hospital. Keep an insurance company off my fucking name just anyway.
Sure.
You know what I mean? I don't even wanna like, I wanna live healthy until I'm 75 and drop dead chopping down a fucking tree in my yard.
But that's like, totally part of like healthcare reform and like reimagining the healthcare system where like completely one half of it is like, I believe that healthcare is a universal right, and I think that there should be universal healthcare in the States, but also the focus shouldn't be on like fixing the problem. It should also be on preventative, on eating healthy, living healthy, you know, like.
But that's not part of the cycle I'm talking about. Like doing that throws a wrench in that cycle.
Right.
Right? Because you're not buying that food, and then you're not committing to those medicines, you're not committing to those doctors, you're not committing all your prepaid private insurance money coming from somewhere to somebody that's wildly overpriced so they can only keep lining their pockets. Like, you know, I talk about it on the podcast, so I don't care bringing it up, but within a year, like, going through a shitty situation with watching my mom pass away and like what happens surrounding that, and then having a massively premature son like 3 months early and basically unwillingly having to deal with two super major hospital situations that both fell on my shoulders primarily, you know?
Right.
And it's beyond my skill set. almost, you know what I mean? It's too much for me.
Sure.
Like, it's too much for me to do that and then do everything else like life demands. Like, I don't have time for it, and I don't have the mental space to even deal with it.
Sure. And, or add on top of that, too, like, within the course of this tour, having, I had two friends pass away and had to see both of those friends have their friends and family post GoFundMes to cover their funeral expenses, you know? And it's like, that is just disgusting to me.
Crazy.
Like, as an indicator of where we are as, like, a society, you know, like, is just abysmal.
Yeah, and with how much money there is for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you can give me advice, like, so that synagogue shooting in San Diego happened, like, this morning, I think. And a few people were killed, like, during a Passover ceremony.
Right.
I, like, feel the need to, like, say something, because I'm, like, Jewish and people just know I am. And I feel like maybe I could give a certain point of perspective that, like, some people don't have. But I don't have anything, like, positive to say. If I don't want to say anything, like, what can I do with that energy?
What was the quote? I was reading this book called Self Portrait, which is the biography of the artist Man Ray, a photographer, painter. Mm-hmm. And there was a quote that I read this morning that was something like, practice the power of inactivity, that I thought had a lot of validity to it. And it's something that I think about a lot in general in reference to social media when terrible things happen. Of just, like, my tendency then is to blackout, is to not post anything and to just take a rest from social media. And to, like, I don't want to be all one of those people, like, who, you know, you have to say something, anything, you know, like, for your image or whatever. You have to comment on every terrible thing happens, because otherwise it means you don't care or something like that, which is just ridiculous.
Yeah, that's what it feels like now. Like, everybody, like, yeah, when something like that happens and you see all the just homogenized, like, you know, quotes from politician A, politician B, because their press team told them they had to say something.
Right.
And if they didn't say something, they'd be criticized for not saying anything.
Right. And it's just dishonest posting something then, you know? And obviously, talking about it too, it's like, if there's no power in it and if it doesn't change anything, then you're just channeling your anger, or you're channeling the way you're feeling into something that's ineffective, and what's that really going to do?
Right.
You know?
It just makes you more angry.
Yeah. Even if you think on the surface you did something subconsciously, you got to know you didn't really do anything and it didn't really change anything, you know?
Yeah.
And, like, I don't know. I feel like with social media jumping around, too, like, that oftentimes, anytime I've expressed anger on there, it has been effective in the worst ways, you know, in receiving responses from trolls or from people, like, in wanting to argue or, like, come at you or attack you, where that does, like, energize those people, and it creates a hatred, and it fuels that.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if you're posting positive things, like, that more falls on deaf ears and doesn't do anything.
It's
like,
true.
Thinking back to a year or two ago when Kathy Griffith posted that photo of her, the decapitated Donald Trump head. Like, I interacted with a bunch of people online who were coming at me because I defended her.
Right, some of you remember that.
And I was just being like, yeah, fuck you too, fuck you, you know, like, and those people I realized were, like, after a while I started getting scared in a way of, like, what if these people decide to come at me, you know, like, come to a show and attack somebody or anything like that, which I see as a far more likely scenario than me tweeting something positive and, like, somebody being like, I'm gonna go out and help somebody and change the world, like,
no,
that's way less likely to happen, you know?
Yo, you gotta know, I was ready going into this tour. I thought
Son
about it.
Sounds terrible.
I was like, there's a chance somebody's gonna come to these shows fucking illin. And I was ready. I want you to know, I was down. We talked about it even as a band. We're like, yo, some fucking asshole might come to these shows. We're like, yo, we got it. We're like, we're a support band. That's what we do. That's what we do on this tour.
I appreciate it.
Yeah.
I think about that a lot, and it terrifies me, you know?
Like, do you have Jake or anybody say anything specific to security about, like, things to look out for
Me, we're, like, really, we're pretty strict about it, and we'll do security meetings and, like, you know, pretty instructive with everything, but you know, oftentimes you're at the mercy of the venue as to what their procedures are and everything like that, yeah. You know, and like really, unless it's a venue that's like doing wand downs and stuff like that, like what can you do, you know? It's what a shitty reality.
You ever think, like, have you ever thought about doing stuff to have more security for yourself, or you think that's just like a bad way to live?
I feel like whenever,
because I know you can fight a little bit, so
whenever I feel unsafe, I feel like stupid for relying on other people to have my back in those situations. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And anytime in situations like the other night in Asheville, when at the end of the set I came up to check the stage and there was like a line of people that was stretching in between the front room and to the back room. There was like the doorway or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And like I got stopped and, you know, started talking to people, taking pictures, signing stuff for them or whatever. And one of the people working at the venue came up to me and was like, hey, we can't have people blocking this doorway. Got to get people to move, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, I didn't tell people to line up here. I'm trying to get them to move by, you know, doing what they want me to do. And they'll go
kind
on.
Kind of your job here.
Right. Yeah. And he then immediately was just like, hey, everybody move, you know, got everybody to move. Yeah. And then the way we moved, instead of it being a line, it was a circle of people around me on all sides. And then I'm in a situation where, like, I don't know who's behind me. I don't know what's happening. And I'm, like, trying to do the same thing, take pictures or whatever. And those are the situations where, you know, even on the small level, I'm like, fuck, make sure my cell phone's still in my back pocket, you know, like, or whatever. Just, like, I don't know what's going to happen. And there's been, you know, there's been many times after shows, same thing, like, just walking out to the bus or whatever, where, like, I'll recognize, like, this is not a good situation for me to be in, but I want to be polite, and I want to, like, I don't want to bum out a fan or anything like that, so I'm going to still be here. But, you know, like, sometimes then the alternative to that is, like, what, do I want to have the security guard from the club walk me out, and then the security guard's going to fucking misgender me the whole way to the fucking bus, and it's going to be a thing, and it's just going to suck. I'd rather take the risk, you know, like, and that's, like, you know, the way I feel most of the time about it.
It sounds like kind of like a weird, lonely place to be in.
Sure.
It sucks. Do you feel like it's almost like how people think they, like, know you? Without knowing you, like, is it almost, like, too familiar just because someone who's been an Against Me fan for a long time has just seen a million interviews and kind of knows your take on a lot of stuff?
I have a book out. Like, people do know me in a really intimate way, true, you know, like, that, and surprisingly that, I don't know, there hasn't been many instances with that actually making me uncomfortable, you know, like, specifically. I think more oftentimes it's, like, there's a detachment that's almost like a glaze with people where, like, we did this thing in Chicago after a show we played there where we were supposed to, like, DJ at an after party or whatever. And we went to the place where we were supposed to DJ. And the DJ booth is in the very back of this bar. The bar is full of people. We walk into the club and, like, all of a sudden I'm doing this thing, which is really not me, where I'm, like, walking down an aisle of people shaking hands as I'm going. And it's like, this sucks, you know? And, like, get back to the DJ booth and, like, Inge jumped behind the turntables or whatever and started playing songs. So then I'm just standing there, and, like, people come up and try to talk to you, and it's like, I'm deaf. If there's other fucking music playing, I can't hear what you're saying, no matter how close you are to me.
Yeah.
So, like, I started having a panic attack, and I went outside of the bar and, like, went and, like, just stood, like, a half a block down. And then as I was standing there, I noticed, like, a couple people come out of the club and they start walking down towards me. And, like, you know, they're looking like they're lighting up cigarettes or whatever, but I could tell they wanted to talk or whatever. And they got towards me and I was like, hey, y'all, like, I'm having a panic attack right now. I just, like, need 2 seconds if I could just, like, just breathe for a second. And it was, like, literally after I finished saying that. Literally after I finished saying that, they're like, so can I get a picture real quick or can I get a selfie? And I was like, I got to go, you know, and, like, went down to the other side of the block and, like, continued having my panic attack. And then people came down that way after, like, I totally verbalized, like, I'm having a panic attack. Can you just leave me alone for a second? And I had to, like, literally run and catch a cab and just bolt and get the fuck out of there because I couldn't handle it. And no matter what I was saying to people, it's like they weren't listening to me, even though I was completely verbalizing the way I felt and the what I wanted, you know?
Sort of like kind of inhuman almost.
Just like, and it, again, it's like a glaze, you know, it's like, yeah. And I get it where, like, thinking about it afterwards, it's like they're in their head, they have what they're going on, like they're what they're going to say is right there in the front of their mind, but it's hard, it's, so they're not listening to what you're saying because it's their moment or whatever, but I don't know.
And then more often than not, they're going to come up to you and say, like, oh, your music saved my life. Like, something, like, really awesome.
Right.
That, like, means a lot.
And I appreciate
that.
No,
I know. Like, but that's what's crazy about it is, like, it's this insanely cathartic experience for them. But how are you supposed to, like, share that experience, like, uniquely, like, with every single person? That's an impossible thing to ask.
Yeah, you can't do it genuinely, too.
Exactly.
And if you genuinely appreciate it, I genuinely appreciate it, there's no way in this situation I can genuinely show it to you just because that's not in my constitution as a person.
Exactly.
That's like opening presents in front of people makes me really uncomfortable.
Right.
I don't like to open a present because I can't show that I appreciate it.
Right.
You know, even if I do genuinely appreciate it.
Sure.
But there's, you know, like one more thing that made me think of too with like safety stuff is like on this tour, you know, we had someone in our crew go home early because of a medical issue, which meant that there was an odd number of us. So three hotel rooms, everyone in the band was like, you go ahead and you take the solo room, which on the one hand I was like very appreciative of. But then there's those moments where I'm like, I kind of feel a little freaked out alone in this hotel now. You know, like it's late at night and I'm by myself, you know, like, and there's like, you know, you're stuck in this rock and a hard, between a rock and a hard place where it's like, if I say something, everyone's going to think I'm an asshole because I'm the one who got my own hotel room. But in truth, I feel a little freaked out. And also, like, I live alone and I kind of actually like the company and want to share a room with somebody because I'll have someone to talk to.
As much as the space is nice, the Hampton Inn in Iowa isn't really bringing the best out of me right now. If you're a uniquely gifted songwriter, and especially someone who started coming up as early as you did, it usually doesn't come from a place of like social joy, you know what I mean? Like grace. It comes from like angst. It comes from isolation. It comes from like the rock and roll people love the most comes from the darkest places of like a human.
100%.
And like, but then they expect, you know, a diplomat. The odd balance that social anxiety is a consistent thing with a lot of people who write songs.
Right.
You know, and then like, and then you're literally forced to like be that person and sometimes create some version of yourself to even be able to deal with it. And then that version becomes whatever it is. Like, it's a strange thing.
Or the flip of that too, coming from like a unique to the, if you're the singer and you have to speak on stage, it's like, that was like the hardest part of playing shows for me. It was like, okay, I got to start talking in between songs.
Yeah,
and like, you know, then you like, it's hard to like, okay, I should be a little funny. You know, I got to come up with stuff to say. And so like, you become this person who does this thing on stage and you have this persona on stage or whatever. And then like the thing to switch that off, to look for things to say or to be sharp and quick witted or whatever, like, you'll find yourself then in the van with the rest of your band. It's like, that doesn't turn off. And then you're like, oh, I'm being fucking obnoxious, you know? And this isn't even who I am.
Yeah.
It's just like a thing that I've developed because I got to be on stage, you know? Like, fucking now everyone's annoyed with me. And like, you know, I don't want to be like this.
Sure. I was wondering, you know, you're often talked about as a songwriter, but you're a guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how often do you like pick up the guitar and just play?
I play every day.
Like, constantly?
Every day.
Like, are you getting up and trying to write, or are you just, like, actually practicing, like...
When I'm home, like, my routine is wake up in the morning, get my daughter ready for school, take her to school, then I go to my studio, and I have a playlist on my phone that I'll play bass for like a good hour or so first, and I have a bass warm-up playlist, and I'll just play along to songs on my bass warm-up playlist, and I'll play through those. I'll do my vocal warm-ups, and then I'll play through, like, I didn't until like the last 5-6 years actually get really into like learning other people's songs. Before, it was always like, just keep practicing your own shit, and that got really old. But then I'll like, whatever Like, I have a notebook folder full of songs that are cover songs that I'm, like, working on, and cool. I'll just play through those either by myself or, again, along to the recordings, and I'll just do that, and then after that, I'll move on to, like, okay, now I need to do a little bit of writing and see if I feel creative or whatever. I wrote a song on the last Weezer record, and after that, I started really looking into, like, how Rivers works, and I listened to his Song Exploder podcast, which was really fascinating.
What's it called?
Song Exploder. They, like, will take a song, break down the song, talk about how cool. it was written.
And he has, like, a very cerebral way of looking at songwriting, right?
It's very just, like, Excel sheets, you know, cadences, this many consonants in a line, you know, like... And, you know, there's probably a younger version of me that would have been like, that's bullshit. But, like, older version of me is like, that's really smart, you know? Like, and that's, like, that's what you have for the commitment to your craft, you know, or whatever.
Sure.
But there was a book that he recommended called The Artist's Way. And I read that, and it's, like, a course. It's supposed to be, like, I think it's, like, 3 weeks long or whatever. And each week it tells you to do a new thing in order to just, like, open up your creative pathways and, like... This whole tour, I've done the one thing, which is your morning pages. I wake up, I write 3 pages in my journal, no matter what. Yeah. Even if I have nothing to say, I just fill up 3 pages. And I try to be the same way with guitar, of just, like, you know, focus on it. Find a thing that you can do every day, even if it's completely mechanical and robotic, just to keep the muscles going and, like, to stay in the practice.
So you, I keep talking about the, like, Vonnegut used to talk about the people who are just, like, disciplined people and then creative people. You seem to definitely be on the disciplined side, because that's a lot of work. That's good, though. I love hearing that shit, because to me, like, you need, like, the tools in the toolbox, you know? Like, how are you supposed to, when you have a great idea and you have that, one of my favorite things about playing music and playing the drums for so long now is the idea that, like, something can pop into my head at thin air, and I can do it more often than not.
Right.
Like, I can make my hands do the idea. And that only comes from practice.
Right.
Like, there's no other way to achieve that. Like, it's not just going to, like, pop to you.
I can still see the areas, too, as a guitar player where I'm weak, you know?
What are some songs? What are, like, a couple nuggets on the bass warm-up?
I'll tell you.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious what's got... killer bass lines to warm up to.
I always start with The Cure's Close to Me.
Okay, perfect.
A great song, gets you in a good mood.
Sure.
I've got Close to Me, followed by White Wedding, followed by Hitsville, UK, the Clash song.
Yeah.
Pop Crimes, Rolling S. Howard, real good finger warm up.
Okay.
Why Can't I Touch It by the Buzzcocks. Dumb Things by Paul Kelly. Tuesday Morning by the Pogues, and Hyena by Rancid.
Wow.
That's my 8-song bass warm up.
So Hyena, like, now you're warmed up and you're ready for Rancid by the end.
Well, it's also like, that was on there, within the last couple months before this tour. Cause that's how I started out. I started out on bass playing in punk bands.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I was 13 years old, Matt Freeman was like my bass god. And I used to be able to play all those Rancid songs. And so knowing, like, all right, do I have those chops back yet? I can judge by whether or not I can play Rancid songs.
That's awesome. Did you skateboard?
Really, really briefly. You know, I was always, like, tall, lanky, and uncoordinated, so it was not a good thing for me.
But was skateboarding part of your scene down there? Like,
the culture, very much so. Yeah. And all my friends are skaters, and, like, you know. I had a Lance Mountain Powell Peralta board.
Loved Lance. Went big. Always went big. I always got away with, like, you can imagine, I'm kind of gangly now, you know, and not coordinated, and I was about, like, 30 pounds heavier than this, and just, like, eating, you know, boxes of Morningstar chicken nuggets for dinner, and just, like, a total piece of shit.
They're still so good, though.
They're amazing. I used to literally cook a whole box, and then just have a trio of, like, 3 different dipping sauces.
Cook or microwave?
Oven.
Wow, that's respectable.
Yeah,
that's
refined.
Really respectable.
I was pretty refined. I cooked for myself for a long time as a kid, but I was vegetarian, so I, like, I have some really bizarre, like, recipes of, like, shitty boxed vegetarian food and things you can do with them. I could write, like, a cookbook.
That's, like, my treat lunch for my daughter. I pack her lunch is Hawaiian rolls with chicken nuggets, with the fake Morningstar Farm chicken nuggets with veganaise in there. Really good.
That's nice.
Yeah.
That's nice. We only treat ourselves to fake meat. It's such a shame.
Do you play drums every day?
I try. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't have drums in my house the same as you. But almost more often than not, I'll always get behind the kit at least once.
Well, I can't. This isn't at my house. I got to go to my studio space. Have you ever lived in a house where you can play drums?
For 3 years, I lived in a house in New Brunswick that I was able to, like, play and have band practice in the basement. But I've only had drums in my house for 3 out of the 25 years I've been playing music.
It's kind of fucked up. Yeah. We're like, that's something I think about a lot, because I maybe the same, you know, maybe 3 years broken up. Yeah. I lived in places where I can comfortably sing loudly and not feel inhibited, know? Otherwise having to have a studio space. But it's weird living someplace and not being able to practice your craft where you live, you know?
I'm not in a band that, like, takes bands on tour right now. I'm not in a band that hires people. You know what I mean? So I'm out of that box of, like, if this was Gaslight, I could easily be able to, like, make a really concerted effort, like, professionally to do something like what people have been asking about, keeping tours.
That's fucking hard, though. That's, like, a conversation in and of itself. Like, especially when it comes to crew, like, finding diversity with crew. Oftentimes, it's, like, the hiring options are just, like, I wish there were more options.
Exactly.
Most of the time when you're hiring a crew, it's like, this is the one person we can find to do this.
Right.
So that's who we're hiring.
Exactly.
You know, like,
yeah.
And that sucks.
It's
but
not like you're getting 50 resumes.
Yeah, and then you're like, maybe this one, you know, what do you all think of this person? You know, like,
well, I thought of that too. I was like, if I wanted to hire an all female or trans crew at this point, like, I would be taking, like 6 of, like, the 8 people who exist in that world right now. Like, it's almost would be, like, nearly impossible, right?
Yeah, I mean,
and especially bands who have existed maybe for 1 million years and have their crews set. Mm-hmm. You know, people have been working for them and rely on them for money for years and years and years before they were even aware that they should have been diversifying and stuff like that. Like,
right.
I'm feeling like if somebody as progressive as me is having these kinds of questions, what the fuck is it doing to people who are not even welcome to this at all?
I think that's okay, you know, like, to feel challenged and to feel uncomfortable.
Sure.
And, like, I feel that way often, you know, like, and there's many moments just, like, as a white person, you know, where it's like, you just need to shut up and listen, and understand that, like, and that's something that being trans, like, has completely opened my eyes to, in specifically with coming out and transitioning, is, like, realizing, like, oh, fuck, like, when I was male presenting, I had a shit ton of privilege that I just couldn't see because I was living the privilege.
Sure.
And then when you, like, step away from that privilege and it's no longer there for you, then you recognize it, you know? And just having that experience in my version of it has made me more empathetic and more able to realize, like, I just might not understand the privileges I have in some situations that other people are saying that I have that I need to recognize.
Sure.
And I just need to accept that, you know, and that probably does make me uncomfortable in some ways. And you know what? Like, just feel uncomfortable,
right?
You know, like, you're going to live. You're just going to feel a little uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, also, like, with what you started out saying, like, there, I don't think there's ever been a time where I've been like, that's Benny, he's cis, you know, like, or with any other person, you know, like, I don't think I've ever actively thought like cis or anything like that, even though, like, I of course know the terminology and I understand differences and everything like that. I just, my brain doesn't think in that ways with people. I just like think on a more individual
well,
level.
Well, you sort of
you know?
Have to, right? I mean, cause that's the thing that sometimes comes off strange to me is the idea that, like, most of these positions of, like, full-time musicians and crews and things like that are cis white people.
Well,
in rock, at least.
I think it's hard to define the diversity because because it's been that way for so long,
right,
that, like, you know, that there has, like, people have been left out, and there aren't the people to choose from. There isn't the diversity to choose from because it's been closed doors for so long to the diversity. So, like, just being in this moment now where it's like, hopefully that's the idea, where you're opening it up. And as that continues, and if you promote diversity and you do make the changes when you can make the changes, then that'll only continue to expand. And then you'll have greater options and you can do that. But, like, I don't know, for me, when it comes to bands and stuff, like, I will always judge a band based on whether I like their songs and whether, like, I respect their ability as musicians, like, regardless of sex, gender, age, anything like that. Like, I can't lie to myself when I hear the music and when I see the way they're playing. Like, I will just know, like, that drummer sucks.
It's almost 7.
Cool.
We can go in before Doors. Thanks, Laura.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
All right.
Well, that was fun.
So where was that?
That was in Nashville, Tennessee, at a place called the Basement East.
As you can hear the birds and the fire department.
Mm-hmm.
Of
we actually also witnessed, at the time of the interview, we saw a man in a pickup truck doing some really strange things, like getting in the pickup, driving really fast into his driveway, and then, like, getting out, looking at something, and then, like, reversing. And and I, you know, my head always goes, like, especially when I'm down in Tennessee, I'm like, oh, active shooter. Here we go. This is some...
Danny, you're going to get in trouble for that.
What? What, baby? This falling down kind of thing. You just had the day that put it all over, that's man. True, you know? Right? You never fucking know.
Falling down, there's a good ref.
Good movie.
Where did that take place? Like, Chicago or
that
something?
That was L.A.
L.A., right.
That was L.A.
Right. Of course it's L.A.
Of course. Remember, he runs into the cholos and stuff. That's a big
film.
Part of that film.
Look up that film if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, classic. But it's nice to be back doing the Going Off Track.
Yeah, and for those of you that waited around, we're fucking psyched to have you.
Praise thee.
We're rebooting. We don't have a definite date, but we will be rebooting likely in January.
Yeah, I've already conducted a number of excellent interviews.
Yes.
With excellent guests.
Yes.
That should be shocking in their nature.
So stay subscribed if you're subscribed.
Wait, that's what we're supposed to do, Brad.
What?
We got to trail it with, like, you can't even imagine the shit that these people said in the interviews we just did. It's hot. This is the modern age, Brad. It's not the 90s. You gotta,
do I need to add sound effects?
Yeah.
Did he just say that?
Yeah. Gotta do it, man. It's all about sex these days, Brad.
Every episode going forward, Going Off Track, is all sex.
All sex. All the time.
Half of them are Benny having sex on the mic.
It's like a fucking Teddy Pendergrass song here.
Woo! But stay subscribed, and if you're not subscribed, subscribe. We will be back. We've got these episodes. Watch our social media, Benny. Benny, watch Benny's social media because mine is a slow train to China.
Man, we got to hire a 20-year-old.
Going Off Track, Twitter, Instagram. What's your socials?
I'm Benny Horowitz 1 on Twitter. I think just Benny Horowitz on Instagram.
So
some jag got me on Twitter. You know, I think I've talked about that before.
Keep an eye on those. Keep an eye on those for exact dates, but we're back. We're happy to be here.
And thanks immensely for anyone over the last couple years who I was touring, going to different towns, who said something nice about Going Off Track and said that you listened to it. Definitely gave, like, the juice to, like, fully want to do this,
To tell you the truth, that's what brought this back. Yeah. Benny got sick of – every time he got off the road, he's like, man, I had a few people that, you know, came up to talk to me about the band, but most people just wanted to know when the fucking podcast was relaunched.
Yeah. I'm like, I just played drums, right? What the fuck? Yeah.
We'd rather hear you talk. That's how many drummers – get told that people would rather hear him talk than play drums.
Dave Grohl, Phil Collins, and
I don't hear Phil
sometimes
Collins
Ginger Baker, and then me, I guess. It's pretty cool.
It's a good crowd.
Select company.
It's a very select company. Yeah. Ginger Baker, I like that one.
About Tommy Lee.
No, I don't want to hear him talk.
I don't want to hear him talk.
We've heard him talk enough.
Dully.
But thanks to Acast, we've been recording some of these shows here. And thanks to Tim Ruggieri here at Acast and Ali, who's really hooked us up.
Yeah.
But yeah, keep an eye on the website, goingoftrack.com, all the socials, and look for us in 2020.
Thanks, everyone.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.